But you may proceed.
Okay. So, again, the only argument is between Rashi and Maimonides and the Rambam. The argument is whether that means that the Ben Noach cannot take off a day. In other words, have a day in which he is taking a vacation, or it means he is not permitted to establish a holiday of Shabbos. But the fact that that verse is an allusion to the oral law is agreed upon by all. That's not even argued among the scholars of the Talmud. I mean, among the rabbinical scholars, such as Rashi and the Rambam. It is an argument as to what the violation is for the Ben Noach. So therefore, as I said again, if a Ben Noach wants to be extra cautious and wants to fulfill even Rashi's interpretation, it is quite simple for him to do so. All he'd have to do is do a specific activity, productive activity. It doesn't give any amount of time. It just says that a day shouldn't pass where he's completely unproductive, and the reason obviously is to teach the world a philosophy that it is not a good idea for a human being to just let a day just waste away. That's something that leads towards a disintegration of society, not towards the building of society. Okay, it's a little different than the American value system, but that's the Torah value system. Any questions on this point?
I think we're in pretty good shape, and you may proceed.
Okay, I'm glad that in passing we were able to discuss a little bit about the system of the oral law and about the concept of halacha, which is something which I don't think 99% of the people in the world have any idea of what it is. That is extremely important for Ben Noach to know, the concept of halacha, that halacha is not just philosophy, it's much more than philosophy. And the halacha has a specific structure, and we're obligated to keep the formula that God gave us. And part of the concept of that formula is, again, has to do with what we spoke about last week, and that is that there is no such thing as taboo in the Torah. And there's no such thing as, that's why, of course, I mean, goes without saying, there's no such thing as amulets or any kind of magical objects. The mezuzah has concepts, ideas, and there's no magical omens or anything like that in the whole Torah system. That's all this type of thinking, taboo and omens and superstition. There's no room for that in halacha. And we don't have any such thing. There's no such thing. The Torah is outright against it. And you have to realize, like some people say, what is the purpose of this? Why is everything so specific and have such a specific form? And the reason is, we could ask again. I mean, the Torah does not permit man to create a god that he wants. The Torah demands that man subordinate himself to God. And we could ask the same question about why God structured the atom in a certain way, a very specific way. And man, through centuries and centuries, first starts approaching and uncovering the specific formula, the mathematical formula that can describe the phenomena of the atom and the physical world, the world of nature, the laws of nature. But the laws of nature are very exact and precise. And so are the laws of the Torah, the oral laws, the written laws. They are a precise formula. Now, why God works that way? One reason why God works that way is because God always works with knowledge and with wisdom. And knowledge dictates that if you change one iota in a formula, that's not the same formula anymore. Knowledge demands exactitude. And the halacha demands exactitude. It has to be a very specific way. If you change one iota of that formula, you don't have the formula anymore, and the whole beauty of the structure is lost. The structures of halacha have a logical beauty to them. I was reading recently a book by the Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg, and he writes about physics, and he writes about how when one reaches the higher levels of the study of physics, One becomes imbued with the realization of the beauty of the laws of the universe. And every physicist knows that there's a certain intuition, a kind of appreciation, an aesthetic appreciation of ideas that guides him in his study of nature and pursuing his his approaches, his guesses, so to speak, his hunches, and understanding and uncovering nature. And the same thing exists, this idea, which Steven Weinberg talks about, he speaks about it as a relatively recent idea in the world of physics. He's not aware of the fact that this idea we've had in Talmud for thousands of years. And that's what King David speaks about when he says that your laws are like music to me. And how beautiful, how great are their works, oh God, everything is done with wisdom. And where he speaks about how sweet the laws of the Torah are. What he means is this aesthetic appreciation for the beauty of the ideas of the Torah. And every law is formulated in a very specific way. When you study it, when a person really becomes educated and comes into the higher sphere of learning, one sees an unbelievable beauty in the formulation of these halachos, of these laws. Just like a person who reaches the higher echelons, the higher levels of physics, sees beauty in the formula of the physical world. So God works the same way in Torah as he does in his physical world as well, that everything is formulated precisely and with a certain aesthetic, intellectual beauty. And man has the divine element in his soul which can appreciate that. Now, of course, a person who is not learned, he doesn't grasp this because he's never seen it. It has no meaning to him because he's simply ignorant. Just like a person who doesn't know physics is only interested in putting on his television, so it's a relatively easy action. But he doesn't appreciate the knowledge and the understanding that lies behind that the understanding of the laws of nature that was necessary to harness this type of an object. So the average person has no concept of this. That doesn't mean that his world is correct. His world is not the correct world. The correct world is the one that a person reaches through knowledge and through understanding. The same thing is true of Talmud. People do not, that's why people thought, the ignorant people thought that the oral law and the rabbis, the doctors of the Talmud, were legalists. That's one of the things in the New Testament where they criticize the Pharisees. But they simply did not understand. They weren't learned and didn't understand what the Pharisees were saying. Pharisees were saying that there is an unbelievable system of knowledge here and beauty. And it's not legalism. It would be like saying the world of physics is very structured and very legal. Yes, it's true, but it's very beautiful because you can't have beauty if the thing you have is amorphous, if it has no form. And the same thing is true with halacha. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why we have to study Torah, is that one of the prime movers that makes us keep the Torah and draws us to the Torah is this beauty of the laws of God. And when you see it and you appreciate it, you're drawn to it like a magnet. That's why the Torah emphasizes again and again the importance of study and of knowledge. And that's why throughout the history of the people of Israel, the scholars were, from the time of Moses, the scholar is always the central figure, the central Torah figure. And throughout the centuries, the ones that made the decisions in the Talmudic law, which was the whole essence of what today is the Orthodox system of Torah, was always done by the, all these decisions were always made by the scholars of Israel. And it's very technical. There's no question about it. It's technical. But the technicality is, again, an intrinsic and integral part of the system, because that's where the beauty of the understanding of the system lies. Without the technical structure, without the precise formula, there is no beauty to the Torah. The beauty of Torah emerges from the halacha and from the specific formula. Now, some of these things may sound very strange to people, But again, it's strange to a person that doesn't study it, just like the laws of physics are strange to a person that doesn't study it. I'll give you an example. See, that's how halachic decisions are rendered. I'll give you an example. For instance, the law of the menses, okay, that a woman, when she's menstruating, cannot live at that time with her husband, with anyone, actually. So this is found in Leviticus 15:19. Okay, if you have a Bible, you can check it out. 15:19. So this is discussing. Well, actually, this is discussing. There's two aspects of this. One is that she is tamei, which is with regard to the mikdash, with regard to the temple, and then also that she's not permitted to live, to have sexual intercourse during that time. The verse that I gave you is mentioned with regard to the temple, but it's the exact same phenomenon. The one with regard to sexual intercourse is 18:19, okay? 18:19, but it's the same phenomenon. The reason why I referred you to the first text, I'll show you in a moment, but the text states that, I don't know which translation you're using, but basically it states, I'll try to do it as close as I can to the text. It says, if blood will be oozing from a woman, which is referring to the menstruation, so it says, the blood will be oozing from her flesh, in her flesh, actually. I don't know what your translation is. I'm referring to Leviticus 15:19. Okay, then it says, for 7 days she should be in this state of nida. I can't translate. I don't know what translation she is. I wouldn't have to think about it. I think it would be a proper translation. But at any rate, the what I want to point out is the phrase before, where it says that the blood will be oozing in her flesh. And the question, of course, is why does the Torah have to give that kind of description? It already stated in the previous phrase, made it quite clear that it's referring to the process, natural process of menstruation. Actually, it's a little more than menstruation. It could be, it's menstruation, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, it's menstruation plus, because it doesn't have to really be menstruation. But let me get back to this point where I mentioned the phrase, the specific phrase, where it says that the blood is oozing in her flesh. And the Talmud, the oral law, says that this means that the way a woman comes into that state is only if there is contact between the blood and her flesh. So that would mean, of course, that if a tube were inserted, in which case the blood would, let's say a plastic tube was inserted, and the blood would not make contact. It would go directly from the uterus outside of her body, she would not become a nida. Okay, now this is pretty much in the text. You don't even really need to have the knowledge of the oral law on this, because it's pretty much, if you just translate the phrase, you'll see it's pretty obvious that's what it means. But of course, we, as I said, all our interpretations are based on the oral system, and this is what the oral law states. Now, that's the way it has to be. It's technical, but this is the definition, part of the picture of what a woman that is in this state in which there can't be any sexual intercourse during those 7 days, and also with regard to the temple, there are certain laws with regard to the temple. That state is, that's part of the description of the state. Now, of course, you have to really understand the whole tractate just on this. So I can't possibly expect you to understand the whole formula for this. But what I would like to just point out is that and this is important, because people will say, well, what difference does that make? That sounds ridiculous. What difference does it make if she's menstruating? If she's in the state of menstruation, what do I care? If I insert a plastic tube and it goes from the uterus, now she's not going to be, now she can actually have intercourse. I mean, it just sounds strange. But in this lies the secret of the entire concept of Torah. And that goes back to what we spoke about last week, and that is that the Torah is not taboo. And that is the most important concept, I think, for a person to know. If you take a course in comparative religion, which I don't recommend, because the people may know other religions, but they have no concept of Torah, and they try to lump Torah together with other religions. And they will say, well, menstrual taboos are found in all kinds of primitive societies. That is correct, but it's not found. They'll say that that's why the Torah also has it. That is incorrect. The Torah does not have any menstrual taboo. As I mentioned last week, Yalta, the wife of the great scholar Rav Nachman, mentioned to him that everything that is prohibited, there is also a similar thing, or different under different conditions, it's permissible. And that's precisely to remove a person from any kind of taboo system. That's why you have the whole intricate system of halacha. Halacha is a logical system. It's not a taboo system. If it were a taboo, it wouldn't make any difference. In the taboo society, the menstruating woman must be kept away from. In a Torah society, the definition is a precise technical formula. So you could have two women that are menstruating. One is considered in the state of menstruation and one in the prohibited state, and one is not considered in the prohibited state. As I mentioned last week, the case that, that Yalta gave was the case from the beginning of what we call Tazria, but I'll give it to you, it's Leviticus 12. 12, if you read through Leviticus 12, 4 and 5, where there is the blood that's the clean blood, which means to say if she menstruates during that period, that during after 7 days, the 33 days for a boy, and the 66 days for a, if she gives birth to a girl, so then she has double the amount of days, 66 days in which any blood that she sees does not render her in the prohibited state. So there again, she could be menstruating, but she's not prohibited. And the reason is because the Torah never wanted a person to be attached to any kind of taboo emotion, but rather to be attached to a system, a logical system, which has great intellectual beauty, so that again, that's the Torah's idea of raising a person from the primitive to the intellectual sphere. As we mentioned with the idea of kosher, the Torah says you should differentiate between the clean animal and the unclean animal, and to teach the children of Israel. It's a process of learning and of study. It's not a process of taboo. Other religions and primitive societies may have menstrual taboos. The Torah has no such thing. Now, you'll say, well, why did the Torah choose something which in primitive societies there is something similar, with namely a menstrual taboo? This I would give two possible reasons for. One reason is, I would say, is because simply the Torah doesn't have to be concerned with what other societies do. The Torah is a system that stands on its own, which means to say, since God wanted people to practice, I don't want to use self-control, because again, it's more than self-control. Self-control is one emotion against another, whereas this is an attraction to the rational element in man, the soul, that the soul should have supremacy over the instincts. So the Torah wanted to choose a situation in which husband and wife, who can always, under ordinary circumstances, have intercourse, yet the Torah wanted them to have this instinct under control, that there should be a time when they should exercise their judgment against having intercourse. So the Torah chose a very simple thing, that a woman has this biological clock, and it used the biological clock to, it's a very practical thing, to set up in general a way in which the person would have to exercise control over his instinct. So that's a very simple and straightforward answer. I would even give another possibility, and this would be based on Maimonides' approach in general in his guide. When Maimonides shows that the Torah wants to remove people from certain primitive emotions that were prevalent at the time, that the people themselves may have had, and the Torah was very careful to take those primitive drives and give them a different kind of objective. And that's why the Maimonides states that was the idea of sacrifice also, that the people had a primitive idea of sacrifice, and the Torah took that primitive notion. It couldn't stop them from doing that completely, but what it did was it gave this drive a totally different kind of framework, so that it didn't allow them, for instance, the worst thing would be to sacrifice outside of the temple, because then they can get lost in their own fantasies. They can only sacrifice in the temple. In the temple, you had the scholars. The Sanhedrin was in the temple. The priests who were knowledgeable of the halacha. So therefore, this primitive emotion was converted into a higher intellectual experience. And the same thing, I would say, is possible in the case of the menstruation. All those societies had primitive menstrual taboos. The Torah made a halacha out of it. It made a whole science out of the a whole system of knowledge out of this prohibited state. And therefore, it took the people away from the primitive taboo system to a system, an intellectual system of Torah study and the oral law. And this, and through that means, the nation of Israel was raised to a higher level and removed from the type of societies that surrounded them, the notions and the ideas of the primitive societies that surrounded them. So I would give those two answers. But the important thing to remember is that there is no correspondence. There is no commonality between menstrual taboos and what the Torah calls nida in Hebrew. Nida is a different formula completely. It doesn't have to be menstruation; it could be outside of menstruation, and the woman could menstruate, and it could not be a nida. It's a very specific formula. There's another thing they have to realize that results from this: that the fact that the halacha is very technical also has a great benefit for mankind, because while it serves to, on the whole, to cause man to exercise the supremacy of his mind over his instincts, which is our ideal, under certain situations it also allows certain permits to take place. For instance, there was a case in Israel where a woman discovered that when she went to the mikveh, that's after the period of time, after the state of neither the prohibited state, the menstrual state, and then she immersed herself in the mikveh, and then she's permitted to have intercourse with her husband. Now, it was discovered that in this woman, the cycle was very short, and therefore, she was unable to conceive during... in other words, at the time when she became permissible, it was too late already for conception to take place. Now, there was one great scholar in Israel that made the suggestion that she should use a plastic tube which would prevent her from coming into that state, and therefore she would be able to have intercourse during the time that's appropriate for her, and she would be able to have a child. Now, there was a whole big discussion about this. I'm not going to get you involved in what happened. I just want you to be aware of the concept, of the idea. What I'm trying to point out to you is that since the halacha is very technical, it serves the technicality serves a practical purpose too, and that is the amazing thing is that with all the abundance of halacha, the way the formulas are so specific allows man to, at certain times, when necessary, to be able to find... It's not a loophole. I don't want to use the word loophole, because loophole is wrong. Loophole would mean that you're trying to avoid the law. It's not an avoidance of the law. This is exactly what God wants you to do. He wants you to be aware of the formula, to have knowledge of the formula. He doesn't want the thing to be prohibited. Let me just go back again to the story of Yalta, when she came to her husband, the great scholar of Nachman, and she said, "You know very well the principle of Torah." She was a very learned woman, that whatever the Torah prohibits, there's always something that's permissible. And she said to him, "I want to eat meat and where? How is that permissible? How can I do that?" And he told her how she could do it. As I mentioned last week, that was taking the udder and cooking the udder with the milk in it. Now, the question, of course, is that we should ask is, this is a very strange story. Was she crazy? I mean, why she had to have the meat and milk? Was this, it doesn't say she was pregnant or she had this some kind of crazy urge. The Talmud just says she just came one day to her husband and she wanted to eat the meat and milk, and he helped her. He didn't say, "Well, why, that's ridiculous. Why do you want to do this?" In my opinion, the reason why what she was saying to him was, on the contrary, that you see, the Torah does not want a taboo system. What the Torah wants, God doesn't want you to suffer. I'm speaking, let's say, to Ben Israel, to suffer the abstention of pork. No, that's not what God wants. God wants the Ben Israel to enjoy the supremacy of his mind over his emotions, over his instincts. So therefore, if that's the case, so if there is something which is permissible that tastes exactly like pork, or there are certain instances where pork is permissible, it's perfectly right and wonderful for the person to eat it. God does not want restrictions. God wants a certain state of mind where there's a supremacy and a control over the instinctual life of man. That is what man is. That makes him that gives him his essence. That's really the divine part of him functioning. So therefore, if that's the case, it's not that God wants the Ben Israel not to eat meat and milk. No, that's not true. What he wants is a certain kind of supremacy of the mind over the emotions. So therefore, she said, on the contrary, she wishes to eat the meat and the milk to demonstrate that it's not a taboo kind of thing and to experience it herself. There's nothing wrong with it.
Rabbi, you got 60 seconds.
Okay. That there's nothing wrong with eating it. It's the differentiation which is important. So therefore, eating it and abstaining from it is the exact same thing. Eating it in one instance where it's permissible, because you have to use your mind to differentiate that this is permissible, and abstaining when the differentiation tells you must abstain. But there is no virtue in the abstention itself. That's the point I want to make, and that is really the entire system of halacha, and that's what is different about halacha. That's why the Talmud says a person shouldn't say, I dislike pork. It's not that you dislike pork. It is that the Torah prohibits it under certain circumstances. As I mentioned last week, under other circumstances, it's permissible. So that's the basic concept, and I think it's an important one, because it really gives the whole philosophy, the whole unique philosophy of Torah. What is the Torah's philosophy? Is seeking perfection in man. It's not seeking restrictions and prohibitions. Okay, I'll stop there.
Okay, that was good.